Hello and welcome to another episode of Bharat Varta. I'm your host Nirav Kanodra. With me, I have Vaibhav Chaturvedi. Vaibhav is a fellow at Council on Energy, Environment and Water, or CEEW for short. And he is right now in Glasgow. He was with the Indian delegation at the COP26. And we will be talking about energy transition, clean energy, and our aim for net zero by 2070. So Vaibhav, how is it? How are you in Glasgow right now?
Great. Thank you, Nirav. And thank you, Bharat Varta, for hosting me, inviting me on this very interesting show. So I'm here at COP26. Generally, COP is a pretty big jamboree, as they always say. Thousands of people come there. So, of course, there is one is the official negotiation process that keeps on happening, which is more about, finalizing the text of the agreement that all the parties agree to. And then there are a lot of, literally hundreds of side events, that keep on happening, in which we speak as experts. So generally, when we come, we do all these speaking events at the side events. Then we are also, of course, there's always networking happening, because all the top scientists of the world in the climate world come to COP. So there is a lot of that kind of, face-to-face interaction happens. So COP is a great place for that. And then, of course, advising the negotiation process. So that is very important. But let me also clarify, I'm not really officially part of the delegation, because these are all very technical terms. Okay. So we are more kind of advising the government of India, you could say. Okay. And that the advisory happens not just at COPs. In fact, a lot of advisory happens in India. For example, the net zero announcement that was made in the first day of the COP, and a lot of work was happening on net zero since the last 6 months. But everything was happening in India. Here you just come, and here now our job as researchers is to do research, and then it is the political leadership that takes the calls on many of these things. So yes, that was about it. Yeah, so that's what I'm doing at COP, all of these different things.
Okay, that's great. Actually, going back, I think some of y'all might know, but me and Vaibhav go a long way back. This is a mini reunion of IIM Ahmedabad Dorm 16. I was a year older to him, but living in the same hostel. And so Vaibhav has done a fellow program in management, or equivalent of a PhD, from IIM Ahmedabad in the area of economics. And then he's gone on and done a postdoc, and he's been working on climate policy and climate economics. So Vaibhav, why don't you give us some of this part of your background, that what were your research areas about your postdoc, and what have you been working recently in CEEW, and also what all does CEEW do?
Sure. Sounds good. Yeah. So in terms of my background, I'm an economist by training, but in economics, of course, every such subject is vast and got many, many subfields. My focus was on climate economics, which is very different in terms of ultimately the methodologies are all same, but it is how do you apply the methodologies of economics, in which particular, kind of subfield of economics do you apply it? So that subfield has been energy economics and climate economics. That's what you could say. Energy economics simply means that the world runs on energy. It's one of the most important resource. In fact, big shifts have happened across the world when, OPEC was created in early 1970s, and it is very famous incident. There was an oil shock to the whole world, because suddenly there was a cartel that was created, and they raised the prices, because they, as a cartel, they had kind of monopoly over the production of oil, and the world was fixed in oil. So as a response to that, the OECD nations, which were essentially the buyer nations, came together, and they created something called the International Energy Agency to just better manage and, understand energy, because suddenly they realized, everybody realized in the world that, energy is such a critical commodity, they never realized it. They thought oil is kind of free and abundant and all. So since then the world started realizing the criticality of energy as a resource and the potential of energy for, macroeconomic shocks, which is, of course, every government is very much bothered about, that issue. And in fact, in India, as we know, we are an oil importing nation. So much of our foreign exchange goes into payment for oil, and all the even domestic inflationary conditions many times are created by high oil prices. Right. So oil is just one example. Right. But at the end of the day, it is about energy resources. It could be oil, coal, natural gas. Right. So now these are very interesting dynamics that happen. In fact, oil, or rather energy, is a very important geopolitical tool, extremely important geopolitical tool. Now, we all keep on hearing about this nuclear, non-proliferation treaty. What is it? It is about nuclear energy, and it is actually about you know, civilian nuclear energy, that you have a nuclear supply group, right? Essentially, you have to get access to nuclear uranium as a fuel. So on energy, you will see so many such, you know, many interesting things that are shaking the market, not just shaking the energy market, but shaking the other, you know, macro economies around the world. So energy is a very important subject. And my job as an energy economist is to just better understand future scenarios. You know, for example, future scenario could mean in early 2010s, like just a decade back, there was a huge discovery of shale oil in the US. Now that had implications for the global natural gas market. Now, very interesting implications, right? For example, till then, Middle East was supplying in Russia. Russia and Middle East were supplying most of the gas to the world. Now this another supplier comes with such a big, you know, find of these competing gas reserves. And of course, it has implication for India and many other economies. So India has long-term contracts with Qatar. Now suddenly the game has changed, you know, because now earlier Qatar was like almost monopoly supplier. Now we have got another supplier, and in geopolitics became very important. So all the American presidents have started coming, whenever they've interacted with India, they have been sort of saying very clearly that start importing our liquefied natural gas. Essentially, start importing our. So now you would see, you know, very recently the shipments of LNG from the US has started arriving in India for the first time. So that's what countries do, right? They are trying to find resources, and essentially they are trying to, you know, export these resources and all that, you know, to gain their own economically. So these are very interesting dynamics in energy. And my job is to try to understand this, the long-term dynamics, not short-term, long-term dynamics is what I am, my expertise and training is. And with energy, climate is kind of joined at the hip. So because almost apart from the Amazon region, where a lot of emissions are due to deforestation, but everywhere around the world, almost 75 to 80% of the greenhouse gas debate or global warming debate is about energy. So yes, so that becomes very important for understanding the energy sector. So when we are talking about shifting from oil vehicles to electric vehicles, what are we trying to do? Essentially, we are saying, well, this oil producing vehicles are going to have so much emissions. So I want electricity vehicles. And then this electricity also needs to be decarbonized, because the electricity might be produced using coal. India has abundance of coal. We have got so many coal power plants. So now it is not just, it is not just about, you know, decarbonizing the oil, the vehicle sector or the mobility sector. It is also about decarbonizing the power generation sector, right? But ultimately, what we want to do is decarbonize because of this larger global warming debate. In fact, you know, climate risk, all of us are increasingly feeling. I mean, all of us, I mean, you would have seen in your own area how in the last 15 years, monsoon patterns have changed. And they are now so visibly changing, you know, so visibly. So for understanding all of this, you know, big shifts that are happening, there was something called the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that was created in the early 90s, right, under the United Nations. It is a scientific body. The job of this scientific body is to assess all the research that is happening. So it kind of, the assessment happens, they take like literature for 6 to 7 years. So every assessment comes after like 6 years or something like that. And they collate all the scientific literature. And IPCC has sort of three working groups. The first working group focuses on better understanding the science of climate, because we are talking about climatic patterns, the very complicated things. So better understanding the science. The second working group talks about impacts and adapt. For example, the things that I was talking about, the monsoon pattern is changing. You know, I'm from North India, and while growing up in the winter season, fog was so common. Like literally in winter season, we used to see, you know, I don't know, 25, 30 days of fog, right? Now we hardly see 2 days of fog, right? What we see is smog. That's a very different thing. That's local pollution. But the clear fog, we actually don't see now. Now, these are very visible things. And the second working group tries to understand the, you know, changing of these things and the impacts of it. For example, what will be the impact of changing monsoons on agriculture? India is a hugely vulnerable country because of the agriculture. Right now, as we are talking, Chennai was just flooded. And these are so vivid because Chennai has been flooded second times in the last, I think, 7-8 years. Second time. Right?
And
it has never happened.
They ran out of water. So it has had too much drought and too little.
Exactly.
All inside one decade.
Exactly. All inside one. And this is exactly what climate change is about. And this is very risky. It is also known as a threat multiplier, right? Because it kind of multiplies the threats that we face as an ecosystem threat that we face. So my job is to. So essentially, these are two working groups. The third working group of the IPCC is about mitigation. So a lot of my work is associated with the third working group, which essentially says only once you are able to mitigate all these greenhouse gases, including carbon dioxide, then well, impacts and adaptation will hopefully will start going down. But you know, carbon dioxide or greenhouse gas is a stock debate. It's not a flow debate. And I just want to emphasize it, because it is imagine a water tank, and there is water flowing into the tank. So it is something like that. It's carbon dioxide. It is flowing into that stock of GHGs in the atmosphere. And the stock, the lifetime of carbon dioxide, average lifetime is 100 years plus. So that is why it is said whatever we are emitting today in 2020, it is going to be in the atmosphere till 2120, right? So, and the world is already warmer by 1 degree since the Industrial Revolution, since 1850. And all these changes that we are seeing in Chennai, we have seen floods like across India every year now. And the floods are devastating. The Kerala floods, yes. The Jammu and Kashmir floods, you know, on the western coast, we keep on hearing, eastern coast, so many cyclones.
Yes. And,
I mean, these are the frequency has increased, the intensity has increased. So the people now realize that climate change is actually, it's not just an academic thing anymore. When I started in like 2008 on this thing, it was largely an academic thing in India. Now it is so front and center, you know. So yes, so my job is to look at long-term energy scenarios, understand what are going to be the greenhouse gas impact emissions from those scenarios, and then try to find out what are the, how do we change that direction. You know, so we are going in a particular direction based on our current institutions and current way of living. If we don't want that future, how do we change that future? You know, so something like that. And what kind of policies are required? What will need to happen to change that kind of future? So that is what my job is. And my institution, which is Council on Energy, Environment and Water, essentially works on many different areas of energy, you know, climate, environment and water, as the name suggests, ranging from, you know, energy access, which is a very important development concern for India. Then looking at livelihoods, you know, distributed renewable. So essentially, we also work with startups in the energy domain. My colleagues work on startups, but these are decentralized energy-based startups, not like cryptocurrency startups, you know, decentralized energy-based startups in the rural areas to just, you know, for ensuring. So essentially, everything is about energy. We work on climate finance, then industrial sustainability, mobility sector, you know, technology, trade, governance issues. You know, I mean, we have got a pretty very vast portfolio of work. What I lead is I lead the long-term modeling work, which tries to get information from many of these, you know, our teams that are working much more closely with the stakeholders. Then we try to get all that information and reflect that in our long-term scenario modeling, which is the work essentially I do at CW.
Sure, no, that's like very interesting. And as they say, like climate change is like there and we're seeing it. So it's a very relevant work, and potentially it can actually lead to a lot of devastation and nothing is done, right? Because
yes,
impact is quite non-linear. So
yes. Yes,
right?
Yes.
So that is quite a scary thing. So
yes.
Coming to like COP26. So there has been a big announcement about net yes. zero by 2070 by India. There has yes. been like a Paris Agreement where the OECD and the Western nations, or mainly EU nations, have said they go net zero by 2050. That was earlier, I think, in the Paris meeting. There has been a commitment by China that they go net zero by 2060.
Yeah.
So, you know, in a very funny way, this is like me saying that I will stop drinking by the year 2050 or 2060 or 2070.
Yes, yes.
But day to day, I will do the same thing, right? So
can
you like elaborate a bit more on what is actually done and what are the intermediate steps? So are there any timelines, say by 2030 so much or 2040, going to like 2050, 60, 70?
Sure. Yeah, so that's a very important question and very... These funny memes are going around, but I hope people don't take the wrong message, because an individual is very different from an economy.
Yes.
We need to see that, right? Changing my behavior is in my control. I can do it. But for governments to suddenly control the, change the whole ecosystem of certain things, we don't expect to have it happen in like 10 years, you know, because of the political economy of things, which we need to understand. And I will talk about these things. First, just some clarification. So under Paris Agreement, any agreement when we hear about it is under the United Nations, you know, which is called UNFCCC, is the Framework Convention on Climate Change. So UN has many different conventions. It might have, for example, a biodiversity convention that focuses on biodiversity. So UN has this specific convention, which is called UNFCCC, United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, that focuses on this climate change issue. and all the COPs that we see every year, these are under the aegis of UNFCCC. And IPCC that I talked about, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, that is also under the aegis of UNFCCC. So now all the Paris Agreement, when we talk about whatever has been agreed upon, it has been agreed upon by all the parties. Okay. So it is not EU or US or anything. Paris agree, any agreement, like whatever comes out you hear, it is actually about all the parties. Parties simply means all the countries, essentially. Right? So all the parties are party to it. So Paris Agreement said that the world should try to achieve well below 2 degrees, right? And interestingly, when you participate in all, or I mean, in the sense of closely observe all the negotiation process. So the well below 2 degrees is also very interesting history. So the island nations are the most threatened. In fact, if you look at the COP speeches of island presidents or the prime ministers of the island nations, they are very passionate, they are very emotional, they are very angry, because island nations are actually going down water, yeah. Right? India is also very vulnerable, but our country's existence is not in question, right? We'll be hit very hard by these floods and droughts and cyclones, which is already happening, but the existence is not an issue, right? Island nations are expected to go down water.
Yeah.
They're expected to be submerged. So they're very different story altogether there, right? So now, of course, there's a lot of emotion involved. So they wanted something like 1.5 degrees, right? You need to stop adding to the stock of GHGs in the atmosphere to ensure that you limit the temperature rise to 1.5 degrees, right? So when we say 1.5 versus 2, essentially there is a notion of carbon budgets, okay? So for example, the IPCC says that for 1.5 degrees C, limiting, we have already warmer by around 1.1 degrees, already warmer, right? But for limiting it to 1.5 degrees in the future, the world has got a cumulative carbon budget of around 400 gigatons of carbon dioxide. Cumulative space, 400 gigatons of carbon dioxide, right? Between 2020 and 2100. So they give all these numbers, right? Now, 400 gigatons is a very, very restrictive, because this we are talking about the world, you know, and very big nations like China and US. I mean, collectively, you would actually, you know, gobble up. With the current set of emissions, you will already surpass this amount in the next like 15 years, right? Because the emissions are... So when 1.5 degrees C means you have to limit the global emissions, cumulative global emissions to like 400 gigaton of CO2. So it is, I'm only talking about carbon dioxide, because there are many other greenhouse gases, right? But I'm talking about only carbon dioxide, which is the biggest one. So now this limit is a very harsh limit. So what the negotiators said, these countries, you know, India, US said, well, it is not possible for us. So well below 2 degrees is a compromise language in the text, because the developed world was saying 2 degrees. 2 degrees gives you like 1,100, much larger carbon space. 1.5 degree gives you only a 400 gigaton, much lesser. So now you have, and this is the interesting negotiation process. These compromises keep on happening. And that is why the pace of negotiation is actually very slow. Like you would see the development and negotiation, they're always, kind of very slow. And this big net zero announcement is actually a pretty big change, right, from India. So it is essentially saying, well, till now there was no such target on India. Now this long-term target has been put in place. This 2070 target has been put in place. Right. So now what the economy needs to align, it is essentially an economic transformation agenda, because you are changing your energy economy, and it is a pretty big thing. And for India, the question is, why not 2050? You know, why not 2040? And see, the question is, your economy is working in a certain way. So much investments have already been made. And India's emissions are on a rising curve, whereas US, EU, all the developed nations, their emissions are already on a downward curve, right? They have peaked long, I mean, they have kind of, you know, they're mature economies.
Yeah.
They have peaked long back, and they have actually, in their developmental process, they've already gobbled up so much of carbon space. In this particular process, India's emissions have to peak first. And that is very important. It has to peak first, and then it has to go to net zero. This peaking is not so easy. We are a fast-growing economy, right? So even China is talked about 2060. The why is China talked about 2060? Because its emissions are also rising. But Chinese growth rates are kind of tapering, and it is expected to taper somewhere around 2030 anyways, you know. So then it becomes easier to peak around that, and then you start declining, and you will need 25, 30 years for reaching from your peak to net zero, whatever, right? We are talking about very large economies. You know, I always say, you know, these big economies like India and China, they are like, you know, they are not a small vehicle like a two-wheeler. They are like aeroplanes. The turning radius is very big. You can't simply say, you know, I just turn it around in a day. So when we look at what date we should choose, we have to look at many things, including what is the growth rates, what is the current emissions trajectory, what are the technologies available, what is the fiscal space that is available with the countries. In India, the income is just around $2,000 per capita. The developed world average incomes are like $50,000, $60,000 per capita. There's a world of difference. So you will need to be cognizant of many of these things. And as you know, the economic philosophy of India in the last 50, 60 years has been mainly on the left.
Yeah.
That is the economic philosophy of India. So what does it mean? It means many of the energy companies, if you look at the biggest energy companies in India, the public, all are public sector undertakings. So you have NTPC, you have ONGC, you have, you know, Oil India Limited, you know, Gas Authority of India Limited, you have Coal India Limited. Essentially, all the resources, energy resources, and the supply of those have been nationalized, right? So these are not very conducive things for all that our distribution state level. Most of these are state-owned. But once you talk about a net zero kind of thing, you need to have a very market kind of system, because the system will be much more sophisticated in the future. And we don't expect that the government system, the capabilities and the skills that are there, it will be able to deliver on that. So you are talking about pretty big tectonic shifts in the way even the energy system is operated, right? And we don't expect for a fast-growing economy these things to be achieved in 30 years. See, imagine for a 2017 net zero, we are essentially saying there cannot be any coal power plant post 2030, because the lifetime of an asset is 40-45 years, right? It might appear too far, but actually it's a pretty near-term agenda that you can't make many of these investments, you know, which have long gestation period, 30-40 years. So that's what we have assessed a lot of this notion of feasibility. And this is sort of a thing which is ambitious and bold. At the same time, with efforts, it could be done, you know, something like that. You know? So that's what is this choice of net zero for India by 2070, and other countries could go earlier. They're already on the downward emission trajectory. They're much more richer in any case.
So I agree. When you mentioned stock versus flow, the Western nations have already emitted in the past, and their bulk of the stock is due to them, right? And yes, now, sir, what they've done is they've outsourced the flow also, because manufacturing is done in China.
Yes,
and then
yes,
because manufacturing is done there, so they need energy there. So
yes,
emissions there are due to consumers consuming in the West. So
yes, yes,
whichever way you attribute it, that's also there, right? So
yeah, yeah,
agree.
You're right. In fact, Prime Minister's speech this at this COP, and in fact, it talked about lifestyle emissions. He was very front and center talking about lifestyle emissions. And in all of our India's official submissions, whatever we submit under UN, it always sort of, you know, has this big concern or big sort of write-up on lifestyle emissions, right? But in terms of the accounting, we have to understand the technicalities of accounting of emissions. So accounting of emissions is production-based. It is not consumption-based, right? So we can only appeal to consumers. But the reality is, when China is, you know, producing goods for US and Europe, China is also making a lot of money in the process. So the accounting thing is only at the end of the day, you are producing, right? And you have to change your production systems. So that's how the accounting goes of emissions globally.
Sure. That is interesting. So you mentioned a lot about like energy and coal, etc., right? And transitioning away from coal. Few other things. I recently read this Bill Gates book on energy transition.
Mm-hmm.
And what he mentions is also like a big chunk of emissions is also due to like steel production.
Yes.
If I remember my chemical engineering days, are like one course on metallurgy, that we have iron ore is iron oxide, and then you burn it in a furnace with coal.
Mm.
And what you get is pig iron, iron, and then you get CO, right?
Yes.
And similarly, cement manufacturing and concrete leads to a lot of emissions, etc.
Yes,
so
yes,
there's all talk about transitioning these away, and instead of burning it with carbon, we use hydrogen.
Yes.
And now the sources of hydrogen, if it is carbon-based gray hydrogen, or if it is, there is the CO2 is captured and stored underground. There's some technology called carbon capture and storage.
Yes, yes.
Then it is blue hydrogen. And if it is like completely green, then it is green hydrogen.
Yes.
So maybe elaborate a bit more on a few of these kind of energy transitions, and
yes,
what are your thoughts on it, and how expensive will it be? See, because it's while we are operating at some level, it is economical and it is productive, but just your thoughts on these things.
Yeah. So that's a very important question, because these new technologies are coming. But let me also take a step back. See, essentially, when we look at emissions, and I'm talking about carbon emissions and generally GHG emissions here, we first try to understand which are the sectors they come from, which are the big sectors, for example, right? For India, the big sectors are not just India, across the world, there are some big sectors. The first big sector is the power production sector. For example, in India, it is almost 50% of our carbon dioxide emissions come from the power generation. So that's big. Second, it's an industrial sector, in fact. So the steel and cement and everything else you're talking about, yes, that is the industrial sector. In India, around quarter of emissions, around 25%, 26% emissions come from this sector for energy use as well as process emissions. Like, for example, cement production, we use limestone, right? Now, that is not an energy commodity, right? But it is used in the process of cement production and release carbon dioxide, right? So together, the process, it is known as process emissions, not energy emissions, right? The process and energy emission in the industrial sector account for almost around a quarter of total emission. Then our mobility sector, which is, you see so many cars and all that, India's mobility sector contributes as of now just around, I think, 11-12%, including all the freight sector and the passenger vehicle, everything. Now, this accounting is actually, in a sense, the numbers are different for different countries. For example, in the US, mobility sector accounts for 27% of their emission. In India, it's only 11%. You see the big difference. And this is the difference of lifestyles.
Yes.
Right. You know that in US, everybody travels by cars for long distances. Public transportation is only in few cities like New York and all. Right. So this is, for example, in France, most of the fleet, power generation fleet, is nuclear based. Right. It's got the biggest installation of nuclear power plants for any country. So, of course, their power sector emissions go down. In Brazil, power sector is mainly hydro based. So they have wind dams. So their power sector emissions also come down. So depending on the country, there will be a different share of each of these sectors, right? But India, this is the share. Like, power sector is the biggest, almost 50%, and industrial sector and mobility sector. And there are other sectors also. Land use is one. For example, in agriculture, rice cultivation leads to methane emissions, yes, right? Livestock leads to methane emissions, right? And then there is hydrofluorocarbons. For example, the air conditioning that we use, right? When we say that this gas has leaked, that air conditioner gas has leaked, it's very common, right? This gas is hydrofluorocarbon. It is known as super greenhouse gas, right? Now, these are a bunch of greenhouse gases, essentially across the economic, many, many different sectors, right? For each sector, there is a different alternative technology. So that's why first we understand which are the big sectors of emissions. Then we try to understand within each of the sectors, which are the alternative technologies. For example, in the power sector, Indian power sector is based on coal in a big way, because coal is our resource, as simple as that, right? The US power sector earlier was based on oil. Now it is based on natural gas by and large. Because, well, natural gas is what they have in a big way, right? They don't have coal, right? So it depends on what is your own resource access and all that. But let's say in India, coal is there right now in a big way. The alternative technologies are solar, wind, hydro, biomass, and nuclear. These are alternative, we can say, low carbon technology, right? Now, each technology will have its own potential. For example, biomass is very good. But for biomass, if you need to divert land from food systems to biomass or bioenergy system, now that is definitely, I mean, there was a very interesting debate in parliament. The debate, I'm talking about 12, 14 years back, the debate was titled as food versus fuel debate, because India at that point of time started investing heavily in something, biofuel plantations. It was trying to do that. And then, well, of course, this debate started, what will happen to India's food supply because of this, right? So biomass has that kind of limitation, right? Nuclear has another kind of limitation, as we know. We don't want nuclear power plant just in Delhi or just in, just because of the perception. In fact, there was a very interesting survey of scientists that happened, I think around, maybe 15 years back, scientists in the public, in which people were talked to rank the riskiest technologies in their perception. Very riskiest ones. So scientists in the list of things, scientists ranked nuclear in around 29th or 30th. Okay. And everything else was many things was before nuclear energy. In the public survey, nuclear were ranked the second or third. That is the difference. So even though scientists keep on saying that it is passively safe and new technology, the new versions of nuclear, in public perception, it is very different. So in real life, policy has to deal with, even though science is very clear, policymakers have to deal with public at the end of the day and public perception, right? So now this is the big impediment on nuclear technology, right? Then wind technology also has its own resource curves. For example, we will have the best wind sites in close to the sea. Like for example, wind. See, wind is a natural phenomenon. Wind speed is a natural phenomenon. You can. It's like coal resource. You know, you don't have coal mines everywhere. You have certain regions where there are coal mines. For example, in India, you know, Odisha, Jharkhand, and coal mines. So wind is in this on certain parts of the country, right? And then you actually don't have so much potential of wind. So it ends up being in the power sector solar in a big way. So that is why we say in India, the biggest potential is of solar. Of course, there is no silver bullet. Every technology will have to play a role, including nuclear, biomass, wind. But solar is going to be something, you know, that is the power sector, right? Now coming to your hydrogen question. Now hydrogen is an emerging technology for the industrial sector,
yeah.
Right? But hydrogen, as per current understanding, see industrial, when we say industry sector, there are many, many different kinds of applications, right? For example, there is a low heat application, there is a high heat application, you know, many different kinds of application, right? So hydrogen is also, the application is limited to a particular kind of heat, something like that, right? So it cannot replace coal and others, natural gas in every process. Right. So the expectation is definitely for that reduction process, which is in the steel production process, as you talked about, you know, that where carbon dioxide was released and coking coal was used. In that process, hydrogen can be used. But beyond that, I mean, there are some processes where it might be used, but a very important technology, no doubt about it, for that particular process. But every technology, as I said, no technology is going to be a silver bullet. In each sector, we need to find what are the alternative technologies, right? The cost of hydrogen is very high now, and you talked about green, blue, you are right, depending on the fuel. So hydrogen is not naturally available, so to speak, right? So you have to produce it using and the production process. Essentially, it's an electrolysis process. It's very simple. It's an electrolysis process, which is very basic. The question is, what is the energy you are using in the electrolysis process, right? So the moment you use coal for the electrolysis, it becomes a very different kind of shade of hydrogen. And the moment you use, renewable energy, it becomes green hydrogen. So it is just about that what process you use for electrolysis, and the cost of green hydrogen as of now is very high, right? But that is where we know that Reliance and Adani's have jumped into the game. And whenever these big giants with deep pockets jump into a particular game, then the hope is, you know, that they will be investing and they will be actually pulling all the skilled human resource, and they will change the game in terms of the cost of this technology, right? And that actually benefits the whole ecosystem, right? Once anybody develops a technology, at the end of the day, whole ecosystem benefits from it, right? And yes, so this is just a snapshot. As I said, each sector will have its own set of alternative decarbonized or low carbon technologies. Each technology will have its own cost concerns. The expectation is with time, you know, investment will happen. And that is what the power of policy is. So when you say net zero, it simply means, well, you know, Tata Steel has to find an alternative, as simple as that. This is the reality of it, you know. Government said, we have given you 50 years, so it is enough time. It is two generations. Find a solution, right? So that is the power of these policy signals. Every sector will have to find a solution, as simple as that, you know. Yeah.
Sure. So now you mentioned this, you mentioned the power sector. We've spoken a lot about it. You mentioned the industrial sector. Coming to like electric vehicles, right?
Yeah.
Because for the transportation sector.
Yes.
So
yes.
Here, what kind of things do you envision? Because I think India is making good progress electric two-wheelers. You have a lot of companies starting in.
Mm-hmm.
But how scalable do you think it is? Globally, I think the only big recognizable brand is Tesla. There are a lot of other vehicle companies, etc. But a lot of them are not as commercially viable. Yet. So what are your thoughts on EV? And also, like, as you mentioned, a lot of it is like emissions elsewhere, you know, like electric vehicles maybe reduces emissions in the city center, but maybe it's at the power plant level, which is somewhere else. What are your thoughts on that? And the kind of process of transitioning, see, because we have a lot of stock of old vehicles, how do we transition from these old buses, trucks, etc. to electric?
Yes. The good thing about, first of all, the transportation sector is up for a disruption. That is very, very clear, right? Now, in fact, Tesla has done something like fantastic, because it has given some visibility to the imagination.
Yes.
Right? It has shown people that it works, and it could be fantastically looking.
It's shown that electric cars can be sexy. Like, yes, earlier, exactly. You had like Toyota Prius, which is a hybrid. which is a
Yes.
boring box car and with
Exactly.
lower
Exactly.
acceleration. So yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So there will always be a market for those kind of, stylish cars, so to speak, right?
Yes.
Which is fine. But if you look at the Indian car market, not every car is sexy car, right? We have like, literally it's very, our market is dominated by small cars,
Yes.
right? And then there are so many segments of the market, mid-size and small sedan, whatever. There are so many different categories that have started coming in. So from the Indian market perspective, at least, it is not going to be Tesla that will disrupt the game, because Tesla will always be that premium, right? And Indian market is a very price sensitive market. What is going to disrupt the game is the usual car company that we see all around. So it will not be a sexy car at all, right? But it will be an electric car, right? Because you've already started seeing so many variants of electric variants coming for so many traditional models,
yeah.
So the impediments, all of us know, it is the charging infrastructure, it is the range anxiety. Those are the big impediments on the four-wheeler front. I'm talking about four-wheelers, right? Two-wheeler front, we have already got, Ola is coming in such a big way now,
yes.
Right? Ather is coming in. So there are, of course, there are many, small, many, many companies and startups are coming in that space, which is great, right? Four-wheelers, because the, four-wheelers have a different space. There's so much established companies like, Maruti and Hyundai already dominate the market in a such way. It's a way the entry barriers are much higher in a four-wheeler market. The capital investment you need obviously is much more, right? But what is good is the bigger players have already started, investing money. They're already planning to come with so many electric models, right? Now it is just about infrastructure. Infrastructure is a big deal, but the government is also working in a big way to change this infrastructure. So for all we know, in 10 years, we will see a very different scenario in the electric vehicles, but in a personal vehicle space, not in the commercial vehicle space. Because like trucks and all, they need a much higher battery densities for long distance. That's a different thing that is expected to take a bit longer. But personal vehicle space, definitely we do expect a lot of, disruption going to happen in the next 10 years. And that is where, these things like net zero and all, they simply tell you, well, in net zero, as I said, it is just the envelope.
Yes.
I say it many times. It is simply telling you beyond that you can't. But markets always surprise us.
Yeah.
And I'm an economist more on the right. So I'm saying that the power of market is phenomenal. And we will always be surprised by the pace of change. And the pace, we might not even wait for 2070 in many, many sectors. Some sectors might be there, but most of the sectors will transition probably much earlier. The good thing with vehicles is that the lifetime of the stock is not huge.
Yes.
A power plant is 40 years long, right? But private vehicles, 10, 12 years, that is their lifetime. So the capital stock changeover, the turnover rate, what we say, is actually pretty, manageable in the personal vehicle segment. And you will see whatever people are buying till even 2030, let's say people are buying all these oil vehicles. Once electric starts coming in big way in 2030 and all that, by 2040, 45, all this stock will go away.
Yes.
So it is not a long-term stock. So each sector has all of these nuances, and that's why industrial sector, power sector is where the long-term assets are created. So there the business leaders have to be in a very, who is the buyer? It's important to understand the buyer. So in the mobility sector, the buyers are you and me.
Yeah.
We are the buyers. We are making a decision to buy a car, right? And our decision horizon is like 12 years, and I want to change my car in 6 years, something like that, right?
Yes.
Industrial guys and power sector, they are the kind of buyers they are. They have to look for the next 50 years.
Yes.
Right? So that is why we are dealing with different kinds of decision makers. And each of these decision makers will, of course, be responding to the market realities, but also long-term policy signals. So more than the car buyers, it is the industrial guys and the power sector guys. For them, the net zero game is so important because they deal with long-term in a very regular way. It's a part of their usual business.
So one question, actually, one of our hostel mates has asked earlier is about like the role of, if we want to use up coal before 2070, shouldn't we just mine out all the coal right now and use it instead of importing? I think there were some court judgments, some coal mines were shut, and then we were importing coal for a while. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So what are your thoughts on like climate policy or some policy which kind of helps us or which can be set in a certain way, which enables us to be both economically, so climate economics, so economy as well as climate, both are maintained.
Mm. So, yes, I mean, see, an economy will respond always to short-term disruptions in whichever urgent way possible. So now, because of all this, coal scam happened and all this, at least the Supreme Court came down heavily
Yes.
and a lot of disruptions happened. So of course, the country will say, okay, I have this power plant need to keep kept running.
Yes.
Right? That is something like non-negotiable. So you start importing. And that is one thing, right? The second thing is India does not have a particular kind of coal. So the coking coal, the coal that you were talking about that is used in the steel power plants,
Yes.
India actually does not have a lot of good quality coal.
Okay.
India's in yeah. So India's whatever coal imports that India has, a large part of it is actually coking coal, which is used in this. So India does not have that coal. Most of our domestic resources used in power production, where we are
Thermal.
anyway thermal coal, right? But when the power plants of Adani and Tata's was opened in Mundra in Gujarat, right? Now they are on the opposite side, right? They are like in Gujarat,
East Coast.
and the mines are there on the east side, right? Odisha, Jharkhand, and all. So the transportation cost, coal has a huge transportation cost. I mean, that is actually the biggest component because it's a very heavy commodity. It's a very huge transportation cost, right? So it became more economical for them. And these are private sector guys, right? There is no public sector undertaking that will say that I will buy only from Indian, another Coal India Limited kind of thing. So these are private sector thing. For them, it made business sense to start buying coal from Indonesia
Yeah.
through the sea route. So the landed cost, essentially landed cost of Indonesian coal was cheaper than the landed cost of domestic coal. So as I said, the imports, you look at different things. One is the short-term supply side disruption related imports. Second is the particular coking coal imports, which anyways does not happen in India, right? The third is this private sector, depending on its location, it will forever go for imported coal, right? But now Indonesia changed its policy. So it started levying so much earlier. Coal, when Tata set up their plant, they actually had all of this plan that they will continue to import from Indonesia this cheaper coal. But then Indonesia changed its policy, levied so much tax on coal exports, and then Tata Mundra is like almost, in tatters because of that sudden change in policy. Yes, so these are the realities of international, sort of markets, energy markets and all.
Absolutely. Another thing, what I want to like highlight, or you mentioned about like transportation or like trucks is difficult. I would like to like say that the initiative by the Indian government or the railways in building two dedicated freight corridors and moving that from transportation of trucks to train, which are electrified, already kind of reduces carbon emissions by a big chunk, right? And like higher speed, more efficiency, so more intensity of energy,
Yes,
so that's also a good thing.
it does.
And
It does.
so like moving to the other part is agriculture. So one thing, you live in Delhi, you know it very well, better than all of us. I live in Singapore, and in Singapore also we have this problem twice a year earlier, where it is about stubble burning, so pollution in the air due to farmers. And in Singapore as well, this was palm oil plantations. They were clearing of forests and burning them at the end of the season. So either clearing forests or just burning the stubble after harvest, which similar thing happens in Punjab. So there are a lot of people who said that if there's a whole coast theorem that if you find it inconvenient, then maybe you should either pay, or there should be some policy done that farmers are paid to grow something else, or farmers are paid to like stubble in some other manner to make it economical for them, and you have clean energy in a richer state of Delhi. So what are your thoughts on that? How do you think, as an economist, if you could solve it, or like have a public policy if you were responsible for this, what would you do?
So yes, you are right. I'm in Glasgow. It's much better here, and I'm dreading going back to Delhi now with these pollution levels going spiking and all. But see, let me, okay, first of all, I want to emphasize this differentiation between the climate change debate and the local air pollution debate, just for viewers. It might appear to be limited. They're actually very different debates. The climate change debate is about global warming. That is why there is a United Nations thing. So essentially, carbon emitted anywhere in the world is going to impact India, anywhere in the world, right? And whatever emissions India do, it is going to impact everywhere in the world, something like that. So that is why United Nations comes in. So it's a global problem as compared to air pollution, which is a local problem.
Okay.
So that's why there is no United Nations treaty for air pollution, right? It's a domestic problem for India, right? But it's a very important problem, right? And the solutions are also, you know, these solutions like, you know, these farmers should be paid this much amount. They are all there. They're already there, right? That they, you pay them. In fact, farmers are demanded certain that you pay us so much, you know, we will leave it stubble burning and all. But these are fiscally unsustainable. You know, I don't know how much you will need to pay, you know. So there is fiscally unsustainable. The government never managed to pay them, right? So now technologies are coming. Technologies are simply, you know, at least whatever residue is there, you are able to, you know, make out of the residue essentially, and then later transport it to somewhere else. All those technologies are coming. But the problem is, it's not such a straightforward problem. You know, it's a pretty complicated problem. To deal with so millions of farmers, because the dealing with so many farmers, you can't have a supply chain. You have to have some incentive, and the incentive is so expensive, fiscally so expensive, that the you know, farmers are not ready to accept a lower charge, and the government is not ready to pay a higher charge, something like that, right? So yes, it is a pretty tricky problem. We are yet to see that how do we, you know, deal with it. So that we have dealt with it. At least people who could pay, they have bought their own air purifiers. That's how they private have dealt solution. With it in India. Yeah, private solution. Everybody's so public. In fact, the smog towers, you might be reading so much about Delhi government set up a smog tower.
Yes.
Which is like big, big storm. And they are totally useless. Totally useless. Like, it is just as what you say, as politicians always do, create something big to make it visible. But as far as science says, and in fact, CW has written so much about this, so that these are like totally useless solutions. It doesn't help. Now, ultimately, it is about, you know, all these sources, vehicular pollution, you know, industrial pollution, which is a bit less in Delhi, but vehicle pollution, and then dust pollution is actually big, construction dust.
Yes.
It actually is big. And then, yes, due to, you know, this stubble burning, in fact, the solution, it said, it's only technology is going to be the solution for this. The incentives are always going to be super expensive. So sure. There will be these, you know, whatever technology that have to be given to all farmers. These are like tractors, you know, you could imagine tractor kind of thing. So they are very expensive also. So the government has been giving these technologies and all, but they are very expensive. They are big. So slowly and slowly that reach is growing, you know, for these technologies. Yeah, but as I said, it's a much more complicated with carbon and all that. We know that there are alternative technologies, you know, like solar, and once they become cheap, then it's the same sort of thing in air pollution also. You need to find these alternative technologies that does something with the residue, you know, if, for example, biofuel, it could be converted to biofuel, but that is a, you know, you have to have that supply chain. These are not large point sources. These are not like a coal where you could take coal mine, we could take all the coal in one go. You are talking about millions of farmers spread across such a large area, right? So all those, it's always in the agricultural sector, the supply chain issues and the cost of supply ends up being so big that in the terms of the business sense, you know, it has never made business sense, right? But still, this is something that is, you know, many different solutions are emerging. And hopefully a combination of solutions will be able to tackle the problem soon. Till then, we will continue to use our masks and air purifiers, you know, unfortunately.
Okay, so actually taking a step back from air pollution back to climate change. So you mentioned the patterns of monsoon are changing. India, while agriculture is smaller percentage of economy, but it a percentage of GDP, which is a very large percentage of the people involved in agriculture, right?
Exactly.
So, what are the immediate challenges you feel for Indian agriculture, and what are the steps that can be taken to mitigate this fallout?
See, Indian, I think the farm sector anyways has much bigger challenges, and the challenges are probably not related to climate. Climate is only going to compound the problem, right? So, okay, that when we talk about climate change impacts, we talk about two things. One is we say slow onset events. Slow onset events simply means temperature is changing slowly. Okay. And even the change in temperature has an impact in crop productivity. So for most part, it is said when in 20 years from now, our crop productivity compared to whatever would have been in the future, because crop productivity is also growing. So let's say the our because India's crop productivity is actually very low compared to the world. We're very low because of whatever reasons, yeah, but it is very low, right? So now that crop productivity, let's say, was supposed to double in the next 30 years because of, you know, many in kind of investments. Instead of doubling, it will probably just end up being higher by 60-70% because of climate change. So it will increase, but it will increase at a slower pace because temperature increase has an impact on productivity. But this is a slow onset event. And then there are these shocks. The shock simply means there is a flood, there is a drought. These are shocks to the economy and shocks to the agricultural sector specifically. Those shocks are increasing, those are more scary, right? So the only way to deal with these shocks is like the finance. So finance is a big thing, right? Both in climate debate as well as agriculture. It is essentially insurance, right? Somehow through insurance, you are able to do it. But insurance, as we know, the insurance industry, because of so many reasons, which is another complicated thing in the agricultural sector, is not worked so much. You know, because they end up wanting higher premiums and anyways, farmers are not able to pay these and all that. So insurance has not really worked, right? So yes, it is a scary situation actually. You know, so what happens if you see what happens in reality, whenever a drought comes or this kind of flood comes that wipes away all the crops and all, at that point, government announces a compensation package.
Yeah.
That is the general, which is all, of course, that's a fiscal hit on the government. And then its delivery is always, you know, half the farmers probably get it, half don't get it, they get half the money, they get two installments, don't get other two installments, you know, all those things. That is the, you know, how politicians with less resources will be dealing with it. If I don't have money, how do I pay for such a big loss, right? But that is the cost of climate impacts, which the economy is going to increasingly see, right? And there is actually probably no way to, there are measures called adaptation measures, which reduce. So that is what the whole debate, there is a big debate or rather thing on adaptation, which is essentially talking about, you know, making the agricultural sector less vulnerable, you know, less vulnerable, and it's got higher adaptive capacity to all of these shocks. So there are many, many interventions, and many technical interventions for that also, which are anyways being followed. But broadly, the exposure is increasing. That is my first point. The exposure is increasing, right, to all of these shocks. So even if you are able to adapt yourself, you are still going to be hit. You know, that is also going to be the reality. And yes, farm sector, you know, farm sector reforms was long due, right? And that is another process that is anyways happening. And that's another, we are seeing the kind of, you know, hit back the government is getting, and many different views prevail on this, right? So yes, so those are, broadly speaking, farm sector is exposed in a big way. We should keep on expecting these shocks to this part of the economy. And the only way is to enhance the adaptive capacity of the sector, which has got many, many technical limitations.
Sure. Yeah. So we've covered energy, we've covered environment. A little bit thoughts on like water, if at all, like what are your broad thoughts? We mentioned earlier on the podcast, like Chennai is having floods right now. It had like water table ran out 4 years ago, and it had floods like again, like another 7-8 years ago. So just a few thoughts on water.
Yeah. So well, water and climate is also very much related, because one of the biggest impacts of climate change is supposed to be on the hydrological cycle. So they're actually very much aligned, and we know water is life, you know, as they say.
Yeah.
And as they say in all our savings, you know, water is actually life. The prediction is that in 50 years or 60 years, you know, if glaciers melt, our rivers will not be, instead of being perennial rivers, they will end up becoming seasonal rivers, which is a very scary thing. Yes, so water, of course, water is heavily related to the climate debate, but irrespective of the climate angle, India is anyways a water scarce economy program, irrigation management program, and all of these investments are already being made. We do investment in watershed. At the same time, we have these, you know, that minimum support price regime, which is very state. You see, many of these, you know, be it electricity or be it agriculture, a lot of it is state determined in India. The states are very, very powerful, right? So if in Maharashtra region, in where water table is low, but you grow sugarcane.
Yes.
Right? Because sugarcane is a cash crop. And well, we know the politics behind sugarcane in Maharashtra.
Yeah.
Right? So This is the reality of it. This incentives which are there for farmers, they are obviously to grow sugarcane, right? They will obviously, so economic incentives will always trump any of these, you know, environmental questions, because at the end of the day, environment becomes an externality. It is not reflected in markets, right? It's not reflected. So at some point of time, of course, the environment hits back. At some point of time, it will hit back. And that is when you will suddenly see a shock, you know, which is in Punjab, it's already happening. The water tables have gone so down. So now it simply means electricity has to be used. Energy has to be used for drawing water from even deeper and deeper aquifers. So you are paying a higher cost of water. That is the first thing that will happen. You know, you end up paying higher cost. Then the government says, we'll give you free electricity, right? So now you have again into fixing yourself into that system. And all of it is happening because that externality, that environmental externality is not priced. Right. So, yeah. So if you actually don't pay electricity subsidy, then there is still some price. Right. Because a farmer is paying, if especially if it is priced in a marginal way, if you price per unit of electricity. So in Indian agriculture also, even if there is a price, there is a flat price.
Yes.
Flat price doesn't work because there is zero marginal cost. So you pay like 1,000 rupees fixed charge.
Yeah.
And then you can draw whatever water you want. Right. So that does not work. If only if you have a marginal price, it works. Right. But anyway, so these are realities of economics, of economic incentives on water through energy subsidies. So water and energy nexus is also very popular. Right. So this is energy subsidies for water, right, which is also creating havoc for these, you know, energy water tables. And then there is this other agricultural incentives through the minimum crop, you know, support price regime that is also distorting the markets. Together, they definitely. Definitely creating a huge issue for India's water tables. That is very, very clear to us now. And we are not able to do much about it just because of the politics of it.
This is very depressing because anytime I read about, like, just out of my hobby about, like, agriculture and, like, impact, one is we don't price in the cost to the environment. So whether it is stubble burning, etc., there's no negative cost, negative externality cost imposed. There is no negative externality cost imposed to, like, it's like a company's balance sheet getting worse. So you're drawing down on your old wealth, which is the water table. You don't impose a cost on that. You don't impose a cost on electricity. And there's flat prices or like zero prices. And that is why, like, I think agriculture is a big sector, big employer. But because all the subsidies given to it, industrial sector is charged a lot more for it. And I think for India, rebalancing this is like a very critical thing. I think we need smart people like you, hopefully influencing and government policy. Sometimes what is correct need not be popular. And we are seeing that. We are seeing that with the farm laws. And it is a big issue.
Yes.
That always kind of like makes me depressed. So I don't know.
Yeah.
Is there any positive news that you would like to share about what all good incentives have happened? What all good things have happened? Some sort of like a carbon tax, which is there in Europe. So, et cetera. So, what are some positive news that you'd like to share with us?
Yeah. No, I see what you're saying. I don't think we need to be depressed. I mean, we need to find solutions for it. And depression is not going to help us in any way. So, in terms of positive news, I do see actually big tectonic shifts happening already in India's polity, right? So, as I've been, I have said that India's economic philosophy has been to the left of the center for the last 50, 60 years, right? Which simply means there is, we have this love-hate relationship with the private sector. Even now, when the ruling dispensation does something with for the private sector, opposition said it is soot boot ki sarkar. So what is it? It is like it is. You have sort of you know, vilified the private sector. You know, that never helps at all. You know, this is so stupid for the economy to start treating your job creators like that, right? That mindset is hopefully slowly changing. Right. So the Prime Minister's historic speech in the Parliament on privatization was, it is known as historic because it's the first time a Prime Minister so openly saying without fearing political backlash, because till now everybody has been fearing political backlash. You know, in fact, even the soot boot ki sarkar had some sort of political backlash. Right. So now the government tried it, but it stepped back. Now it is in the second term, it is saying, well, I can't compromise on it. You know, it has to be, that has to be India's future. It can't be dependent on, you know, the economic philosophy of the left. So this is a very, very big change. This is a very positive change. The question always is, you know, will the government continue to be in power and for how long? Because everybody else in the opposition spectrum is by and large left of the center. Everybody else, right? So if 10 years after this, you have a coalition government or you have any other party in power, they might go back again to, you know, their kind of policies. And this is the thing that is a bit scary, that India's electoral politics. But otherwise, if this party continues to be in power for, let's say, 20 to 25 years, ultimately, you have to change the mindset of people. And it takes a long time for systems to change, mindset to change. It's not a five-year thing. So a party cannot change this in 10 years. This love-hate relationship where all these private sectors are looked as evils, you know. So it has to change. Hopefully, it will, you know, change in the next 25, 30 years. If this party is there, then we will see a lot of, you know, really the power of the private sector being harnessed in the economy. And that's very positive shift is happening. And net zero, as I've been saying many times, is a very positive announcement. It's also an economic transformation agenda.
Yes.
So it's a very positive announcement, economic transformation agenda, which also necessitates this move towards the economic philosophy of the right, because our current setups is not going to deliver on net zero. We have to have a much more market-oriented system. So very positive developments. I'm very hopeful, actually. You know, I'm not at all depressed. I'm seeing very good things happening in India.
Okay, perfect. So one more thing. So I work in finance. I see a lot of these, a lot of people say ESG, either like green bonds or trying to keep your investment portfolios ESG compliant. So you cannot own, let's say, oil company stocks or bonds, etc. So what are your thoughts on like that part? As well as there is this whole transition, as you mentioned, for to go towards net zero, both on like the power side, power sector, or the industrial side, or the vehicle side, right? The three big sectors. So that transition is going to be inflationary. It's going to cost a lot. And I think our prime minister has mentioned that the Western nations should be paying something or help in climate finance. So what are your thoughts on being a climate economist, like climate finance or ESG?
So, okay, I'll talk more about climate finance because that's what I know much more about. So in the transition process, say, for example, any new sector, solar is a big sector for us, right? And a lot needs to happen in solar. But the banks see this solar sector as a riskier sector because it's a new age sector as compared to coal. So the interest rates on any coal investments, what the banks charge is around 9% or so, right? Or as compared to this, for a solar sector, the rates charge around 14% or so, 14-15%. So the cost of finance is a very, very big issue, right? So when Indian government says we need financial support, it is not that we need whole of your money. Of course not. India's banking sector is big. It will keep on investing. Of course, we'll get a lot of foreign direct investment in this sector. For example, you know, Renew Power is a big company which is backed by Goldman Sachs, right? Which is operating in India. So we will get a many private sector. Adani's and Reliance have already jumped. So all these will happen, right? But the cost of finance still is very high, which makes electricity expensive. And it is a deterrent for investment to come in, obviously, because if the cost is so high. So the government is saying the climate finance is only for something like we need low cost finance, right? So if a Norwegian pension fund, which has so much of money, it keeps on investing everywhere in the world, it should, for example, invest in India, right? And it should say we are happy to take that risk of that additional 4-5%, which is the riskier part of the Indian economy. Yes. And which is a grant, which is really a grant, right? But they're still getting a return on their investment of 9%, the same return that coal gives. So we are not talking about free money at all. We are just talking about low cost money. That is something very important. On the inflationary part, everything in real terms also, as demand grows, it becomes expensive, right? But our affordability is also going to go much faster. So I am not too much worried. I think rather than cost, we need to think about affordability. That is the variable we need to think about. Our incomes are, let's say, going to grow 5 times in the next 30 years. They're literally going to go 5 times, 30, 35 years. Even the cost doubles, let's say, which is a very high increase, doubles.
Yes.
It is still much more affordable, you know.
Absolutely.
So I'm not too worried on that front. I think we will deal with a rising income economy. Right now, it is definitely a concern. I don't think after 30 years, it will be such a big concern.
Absolutely. Another thing is, I have seen like some of the papers you published. We've spoken a lot about it. One is about CCUS. There's a lot of talk about carbon capture, utilization storage. I had presented a paper in undergrad in chemical engineering. And that time found it a little bit ridiculous that we capture carbon dioxide, liquefy it, and store it in a mine or store it in a coal mine or on the seabed. You've done more work on this, and like maybe you can share a few things. What do you think about CCUS? How it can be used?
So no technology is a silver bullet, as I said, right? So solar is big, but solar might, I mean, land footprint of solar is huge actually. Right. So it's huge land footprint. So now if you're talking about a much larger electricity sector, for the next 30 years, maybe a lot of solar will come in. But at some point of time, we'll start dealing with, we have to deal with other externalities of solar also. Right. That is the reality of it. And these are variable energy, so you need a lot of battery storage also. So carbon capture and storage, it is more expensive. You know, it was probably 50-60% more expensive as compared to current coal power plants. Still, it is it gives some stability. So every technology will have its own pluses and minuses, right? So CCS, of course, it is more expensive, but it will allow you to use a lot of your domestic resource, right? So you can use so much of coal if you have CCS out there, right? And then the question always is, what is the larger economic framework under which these technologies compete and operate, right? So if there is a carbon price, which we expect to happen sometime in the next 10-15 years, if a carbon price comes, then a carbon price effectively, you know, incentivizes many of these low carbon technologies. It incentivizes it. And at the end of the day, the role of policy and the government is to create these economic market frameworks, so to speak, right? It is not to choose technologies. Let the market choose technologies. Yeah. Let private investors. So if a private investor wants to invest in CCS technology, there should be no one stopping this private sector investor, right? We should create a framework which allows for all of this investment and allows for a much more fair market regime. The government only needs to ensure that there is stability to the grid. You know, there is security of energy supply. There cannot be price shocks on the economy. These are some important macro variables it needs to regulate, so to speak, you know, consider, manage, regulate, but it should not be choosing technologies, right? So create that sort of level playing field and then let the market choose. If the market does not think that CCS is viable, it is too costly or whatever, it will not come in any case, right? But let us create that framework, right?
Sure. Absolutely. That's great. So before we end, what is the mood like at COP26? I think we've seen a lot about, like, or heard in the media about, like, India's 2070 commitment. Mm-hmm. How are other nations looking at it? What are some of the policies or incentives? If you've met a lot of people from all countries, mm-hmm. all over, how are different nations incentivizing for the carbon transition?
Mm-hmm. Many nations domestically, they're incentivizing. For example, in Europe, in the electric vehicle space, as you know, the registration charges, which is a pretty big chunk actually in many European nations. This is just an example of incentive for one particular sector. Then there are something called feed-in tariffs. So the solar sector, for example, they got something of feed-in tariff, which is something like an additional amount that an investor gets essentially by investing in a solar power plant. Now, these are two examples. I mean, for many different technologies or many different things, always there is going to be, you know, whenever a technology is early stage, that's when these incentives come in. And when it starts gaining economical scale, these incentives are supposed to be taken off the table, right? And that's how it is happening in India also, you know. Now, that is one. In terms of the net zero announcement, there are two broad views. Many economists like me, we always say the long-term signals are extremely powerful for a particular constituency which have got longer gestation assets. Like, as I said, industrial sector, power sector, they're very powerful, right? And then there will be many climate activists who will say, well, this is too long, this 50 years, the meme that you were talking about.
Yes.
You know, so there will always be though that kind of opinion. When we work with the markets, when we work with the private sector in India, we work closely. And we know these things are absolutely important. Industry wants certainty, right? It always wants certainty. And these till now, there was a lot of uncertainty in the market. Now, net zero kind of stops all of that, right? So that they are liking it. Industry always likes certainty. And yes, I only say it is lack of understanding on many people part who think that these long-term signals are useless because this is 50 years down the line. It is actually a near-term agenda. You know, it's coal power plant cannot be, no investment can be made after 10 years. So that's a very near term. Yes. It's not a long term. So it is just, you know, all of us have our different trainings and looking at these things in a very, very different way. So many people do have this very, you know, different opinion, but by and large, if you look at policymakers, why is there so much buzz? If it is meaningless,
yes.
If it is so meaningless, why John Kerry came to India twice? Why Alok Sharma came to India twice? Right? Well, it means something, you know, it means something, because these people looking at the long-term vision, you know, they know it matters. And similarly, I also know it matters. There will be different opinions, which we should also always welcome these different opinions, which is fine. Yeah.
That is why we need such climate economists like you to come out on such forums, and even in the media, I see you doing a lot of television interviews to communicate this, right? Because for the layperson, what happens is sometimes these activists are a vocal minority who kind of shout out loud and distract people. Whereas we want, if you want to communicate this clearly, it provides a good understanding to the wider public, and that sees it in a positive light. So that is, I think, extremely important. Even the previous chief economic advisor, Subramaniam Krishnamurthy, had just come out with an article about how, like the farm laws, what we mentioned, that a vocal minority or a people with an agenda hijack the conversation. So
absolutely.
And so I think you've said, you've shared quite
let me say, they are, in at least climate, they are well-meaning people. They just probably have a different training, so they don't really see it. It is not like farm laws, where probably agenda, there is an agenda, political agenda. In climate activists, they are very deeply passionate activists.
Yes.
So they don't have any other agenda. They are there for the environment, so they have a very important role to play in the climate debate. It is just that, yes, our trainings are different. We are looking at economies and societies in a very different ways, something like that. Yeah.
Absolutely. And so I think you could share a bit more about what all, say, R&D, either on the technical side or think tanks like yours are doing on the policy side. If somebody, a young listener, wants to be a part of this, what all can they expect? Maybe you could share a bit about CEEW as well.
Sure. So we are a think tank. As I said, we work in the policy space, and one, we do cutting edge research. That is one thing. Cutting edge research is sort of, research which is also published in journals. For example, this net zero paper that I'm just talking about, we published as a working paper, but it's also now coming out in a journal. So which is scientific publication, goes through the scientific process, right? But we are not an academic institution, in the sense that engaging with government is something absolutely important for us. We exist for advising government, so to speak. We don't exist for writing papers.
Yes.
Right? We exist for advising government and various ministries, various arms of the government. You know, for example, in the net zero debate, it has not been just the Ministry of Environment, Forest and Climate Change. I have been closely interacting and advising Ministry of Power on this, even Ministry of External Affairs, because it is such a geopolitical issue. So Ministry of External Affairs has been involved so much into this net zero debate. You know, so again, across many different ministries, we have been advising, and this is just one example. Across our areas of work, we essentially do research. On the basis of that research, you know, we advise the government. So what is important for us is, we don't advise based on our opinion, just random opinion. Our opinion is grounded in a lot of data and analysis and understanding of the systems, essentially. You know, so yeah, so that is what, as a think tank, we are expected to do, and you know, that's what we do. Along with this kind of research, which is known as policy and economic research, there is also another kind of research, which is technical research, right? For example, storage system, battery storages, they're so critical for this future, right? And a lot of technical research is happening in those systems, right? For example, in carbon capture and storage, Nirav, you said you presented something in your master's, right? Now that is exactly in CCS, the Department of Science and Technology is increasingly funding now research, which is in the science part of it. You know, like membrane technologies, how do you capture, that is technical research. So these are just two examples, you know, but broadly speaking, there could be policy research and there could be technical research, like science kind of research. And depending on the interest of all the listeners, whichever way they want to, they can always, you know, move in that direction.
Well, that's absolutely fantastic. Last thing. So 2070 is like really far away. What kind of medium term goals do you think or the vision for India? Because you have to go to that goal, that is a moving target. You said we will, our emissions will rise as the economy rises.
Yes,
so 2030, maybe we shall be not, we should reach 5 trillion GDP a lot before that. Maybe by 2030, we are 10 trillion economy. What do you see on the climate or the clean energy kind of thing? What vision do you see?
There is already a 2030 goal also.
Yes.
As you know, there is already a 2030 goal. Which is called the nationally determined contribution. It is under the Paris also. Every country has it. In fact, the Prime Minister talked a lot about 2030 goals, right? 4 out of the 5 were 2030, and the last one is about net zero 2070. And in fact, now we are expected to come as something called like a long-term strategy. Hopefully, the country will come where you will see some intermediate goals, you know, something like that. So all that process is underway. It will take some time. But yes, many of these things will emerge. Right now, just announcement has been made 12 days back. Many of those things, important information will start coming in, and it's being in the process, you know, so to speak. So we will see a lot more information.
Okay, I think this has been like a really, really fantastic topic. I think we could go talking about this for another 3-4 hours. It's been a pleasure talking to you. It's a great thing where we need such climate economists talking to like a lot of people, talking to common people and spreading awareness. So that is what is needed. Vaibhav, thanks a lot for your time and pleasure having you here.
Thank you for inviting me. It was great talking to you again.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Bharat Varta podcast. If you want to see more content like this, then don't forget to subscribe to our channel. We started Bharat Varta to facilitate long-form discussions on politics, policy, and culture. We don't necessarily endorse anything that was said in this episode. If you wish to offer us feedback, do reach out to us on social media. We are at Bharat Varta on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You could also get in touch with us on our website, www.bharatvarta.in. The links are in the description below. Until next time, stay safe, take care, and Jai Hind.